Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:13 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is July 14th. I thought we'd kick off with carbon credits. There's been a lot of news in the sector. So the Europeans really want to significantly increase carbon trading. So not only are they now going to target utilities, but they are looking at targeting the automotive sector, targeting the airline sector, and then also the shipping sector. So they aimed for carbon credit prices to continue to trend higher. Now they've been stable around the 50 euro area for most of the last few months, and obviously we've had a significant advance over the course of the last 8 or 9 months. But the most important thing is that this is a politically motivated market, and it is higher prices by design. So historically, we've seen that carbon trading has been really very volatile. There have been periods when economic growth undershot, when there was an excess of supply, and we might consider these to have been teething problems. There is now a clear determination within Europe that something has to be done about climate change, and in the short term, that means higher taxes. And quite whether it succeeds in reducing carbon is out there and in the unknowable, but the reality is that it will be a money spinner for governments, and governments really do need the money. And China is now also engaging in its own national carbon trading program. There have been regional efforts within China to create a carbon trading program over the last few years, and now they are expanding that. So China generates about 65% of its electricity, at least as of 2019, from coal, and coal prices continue to trend higher in China. So there is still plenty of demand for coal and for coal products in China. But one thing that I think is relevant is China's demand for coal is obviously a factor of the fact that it's cheap, but it's incredibly polluting, and coal prices continue to trend higher. And this is thermal coal. This is quite apart from coking coal. And the coking coal price has been resurgent over the course of the last year as well. So certainly that has been beneficial for iron ore miners, for the coal companies themselves, and then also for steel producers, because they've been passing on those costs. Will China be really serious about curtailing the influence of coal on their electricity balance point? Well, we'll see. But they're certainly willing to make noises on that front. And they're starting off with a pretty low carbon price. It's a fraction of what is being installed in Europe. One thing that is relevant is that perhaps this Chinese effort is, in at least in part, a response to Europe's effort. And when we think about Europe's effort, well, they are clearly looking to both support the domestic economy. It's protectionist in nature to force other to force anyone who wants to export into the Eurozone to abide by your rules. So then that is also trying to support the domestic European economy. China adopting the some form of carbon credit, even though it's substantially lower priced than the European one, is at least a salve to try and abide by these new European rules. So there is at least a political motivation in China. But what it of course does is it throws focus onto the costs of doing business. And significant costs of doing business are particularly relevant for the shipping sector. So Maersk has been trending higher because they have said in plain English that, and I do apologize. I'm not typing particularly effectively. But they've said in plain English that they are going to pass on the costs. So that has certainly translated into a pretty impressive performance by the share. But we're definitely going to see more of this. And the share for Maersk has been consolidating of late, and it's quite overbought relative to the trend mean. So it's not impossible that we're going to have at least a partial reversion. But the Baltic Dry Index continues to push on to new highs. And this is a clear determination by governments to increase costs. And it's not like we haven't seen this kind of thing before, because we've seen exactly the same thing in the agriculture sector. When we think about the agriculture sector from the early 2000s, governments were looking at the massive inventories of agricultural commodities that were sitting in warehouses and on ships in Europe and in the USA. And they looked at the squalor in which many farmers live around the world, and they said, well, this isn't fair. And this massive overproduction that we had in Europe and North America was as a result of subsidies. So they took the subsidies away with the clear intention of raising prices and hoping that that would translate into better incomes for poorer people around the world. Brazil was extremely well placed to take advantage of that, so they became a major producer of most commodities. And then that contributed to a step change in prices. So then we can think about what that has meant in terms of food prices, because food prices over the course of the last 20 years have gone up significantly. And now we're also seeing that commodity prices themselves have been trending in a downward manner, particularly when you incorporate the contango over the course of the last decade. So we are now starting to see that agricultural commodities are trending higher, and we're also seeing that social unrest is beginning to boil over. So certainly in Cuba, the recent protests are as a result of food prices. Then we can also think about what's happening in South Africa. It might be simply because of corruption, but corruption has been an issue for a long time. Instead, it's much more to do with the pandemic and the loss of income for large numbers of people. And then there's a ban on alcohol sales, and that never goes down well. And then you have the increasing costs of food and commodities on top of all of that. So these kinds of factors do contribute to pressures in society. So when we think about the impact that central planners have on prices, they go in with the very best of intentions, and then you end up with unintended consequences. And what they have the real potential is to cause inflation. And it will be primarily commodity-led inflation because that is the priority in introducing carbon taxes. So then I thought this graphic that was that came out today, I think, was really interesting. It helps to show that the core CPI, ex the reopening and the chip shortage components, has actually been trending down this year, but that the reopening components have been contributing to inflation, and then the semiconductor shortage has been the primary aspect in terms of the inflationary pressures that we've had over the course of this year. Well, the one thing that we should bear in mind is that there is a lot of money sloshing around, and we might think about that in terms of reopening. And then we have semiconductors, and those are cyclical. So let's just think about the quantity of money that's sloshing around at the moment. So we can think about the total amount of money that is moving in and out of the repo market. So it's running up towards about $1 trillion right now. And that is simply because the Federal Reserve has offered more money. So they're draining some of the liquidity out of the market. This is approximately $1 trillion that has been deposited with the Federal Reserve. So in many respects, this is less inflationary because in what we initially had was the US government had a very large balance sitting at the Federal Reserve. Then they sent that out in the form of stimulus payments. Those stimulus payments got lodged at the banks. The banks are relodging them at the Federal Reserve. So the money has simply done a full round trip and been redeposited at the Federal Reserve, except that now the banks are receiving 5 basis points for the pleasure of depositing that money. But what it also helps to tell us is that there was a huge quantity of cash was introduced into the global economy in response to the pandemic, because the pandemic shut down whole sections of the economy. And to compensate for that, then there was this massive infusion of liquidity. Now those sectors that shut down are opening back up again, and they're creating inflationary pressures because the quantity of money that was introduced to compensate for the loss of them has not been removed. So then that portion of the market is contributing to inflationary pressures. But it's less about the reopening and probably more about the money that was introduced to compensate for the loss of that reopening portion of the economy. Then we have semiconductors. Well, the one thing that's important about semiconductors is that the sector is highly cyclical. So there's always a great story. And right now, the story is that you have cryptocurrency mining, which is creating outsized demand for graphics chips. Then you have the advent of autonomous vehicles, which requires much more computing power in vehicles. Then you also have the factor that the semiconductors are required in the automotive sector at rates that are significantly higher than ever before. So this has been the contributing factor in the significant advance in semiconductor prices over the course of the last year. And semiconductor companies are struggling to respond to this outsized demand in the short term, and it might last a while longer. So that source of inflationary pressure is likely to remain a factor. Well, the challenge, of course, for semiconductor producers is that they're under pressure to increase supply, and they're under pressure from their customers to produce more. So they're investing in new supply, and there's hundreds of billions of dollars committed to building new factories. And eventually, those factories will hit the market, and the supply deficit will evaporate, and prices will come back down. So we can anticipate that that's what's going to happen. It's really only a question of how long it takes to happen. So when we think about why are central banks so committed to this view that there is going to be transitory inflation, it's because they're looking at semiconductors and they know that they're cyclical, and they're saying it doesn't matter how long it lasts, it won't last indefinitely. So they're anticipating that those semiconductor shares are going to roll over and those semiconductor prices are going to roll over. And at the same time, they know how much money is in liquidity, and they know that the reopening and that influence on the economy is going to moderate eventually. Of course, eventually the reopening portion of the economy will coalesce with the rest of the economy, and we will probably plateau at a higher inflation rate overall. And if that were the only thing that was worth considering, well, then inflation might well be transitory. But then we have carbon taxes, and those are going to raise the price of everything. And then because it's translating into higher costs for goods and services, higher costs for moving stuff around, then it's likely to also create demand for substitutes. So when we think about the shipping sector, they're just going to have to pay the taxes until new shipping designs are brought online. And that is likely to be beneficial in the short term for natural gas, because natural gas is the expedient way of substituting for coal. So that is certainly likely to be a fundamental backdrop for natural gas prices over the course of the next few years, but right now it's around the $4 area, and it has failed around $4 on a number of occasions over the course of the last decade, and there have been brief flurries above that level, and then it has failed in a really dynamic manner. So at least in the near term, there is the potential that we're going to have some weakness. But as carbon pricing models are introduced around the world, then it's likely to create demand for natural gas simply because it produces less emissions than coal and it's relatively accessible and does not rely on rounds of new technology. Then the new technology sector that is really starting to gain attention is mRNA, and Moderna continues to trend higher, and it was at a new high again in here today. They are making a big bet, and it is that they can circumvent the long trial process. So historically, clinical trials take years, and the mRNA vaccines were pushed through in less than a year. And that was possible because they were able to come up with the basic makeup of their vaccines within days of getting the genetic material for the virus. Then it was a question of testing it through the process. And they were given the benefit of the doubt, and we're all lucky that they have been able to come through with a product in such a short period of time. So they want to then use that processing and the efficacy data that they have come up with so far and deploy it in other sectors. So rather than the bet that it's useful or not, what they are in fact betting is that they can circumvent the years of data required in the conventional method, because they're basically saying that it's all the same and the mRNA is easy to insert into the body, and rather that they just have to change what the instructions are. So once they are permissioned for one, then the permitting process should be shorter. So this is a big gamble. If they can get away with this and they can make their case and it's accepted by regulators, well, then it's likely that every company will be doing mRNA in the future, because why wouldn't they? So this is certainly a subject to pay particular attention to. Then we can also think about what has been happening with Biogen. So the share has been subject to an incredible amount of volatility over the course of the last few years, and all of that, those big pops on the upside and then big declines since 2019, have been to do with the Alzheimer's cure. Or, well, that's not true. It's not a cure. It's a treatment. And because there is no other treatment, then the fact that this one has been permissioned creates a significant market for it. And a lot of insurance companies are saying they won't pay for it. So when you go down the route of trying to create something and then you try to fudge the data, well, you might end up with a product you can't sell. And that is potentially what Biogen is looking at. So this is where the gamble is. It's not so much about whether Moderna can come up with products that can treat things like cancer or HIV, but rather just how successful will they be in navigating the approval process? Because Project Warp Speed was a gift for the sector. And now the bigger question is, how can the companies make that work for them in future and also make money at the same time? And of course, then they also have to circumvent the very real prospect that genetic solutions are going to have difficulty making money in the first place because they're selling cures. And obviously, if you have HIV, then getting a cure for it is worth a lot of money. But it's not quite the same as a chronic disease like diabetes. Because once somebody is diagnosed with diabetes, then they are on a regimen of drugs that will treat the symptoms and not the underlying cause indefinitely. And people can live for years and pay those premiums every year. So it creates a fantastic modelable sense of or a set of cash flows that get incorporated into the share price. Well, if you're creating cures, you only get paid once. So it behooves one then to ensure that creating cures gets cheaper, not more expensive. And the trend overall of creating new drugs has been to become progressively more expensive. So then this is where the question is it going to be something that will contribute to lower prices overall? And that is particularly relevant for the biotech sector. The share or the ETF really hasn't gone anywhere this year. And the big question is, how well will these companies, as technology improves, will they be able to come up with a business model that can justify their valuations? And it's an awfully big question. So we can think about where inflationary pressures are rising. We can also think about technological innovation continuing to increase. What it means is that there are going to be points of the economy where there is evidence of deflation, and there are going to be points in the economy where there is evidence of inflation. But we're at a point now where we have restive populations around the world, so they're going to want to see standards of living improve. And that suggests that we're going to have inflation, and it is looking increasingly likely that gold has put in a higher reaction low. So it would be natural to anticipate that gold prices will do well in a broadly inflationary environment where the liquidity stays in the system for longer, despite the fact that we're going to have a recovery in any case. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.